Hello, everybody, and welcome back to yet another Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell, and today we've got a guest who is a specialist in the atmosphere. She's an atmospheric chemist, and she has come all the way from Boulder, Colorado, where she's on the faculty there, and her name is Eleanor, or Ellie Brown, Brown with an E, if you want to check her citations later on. And so, Ellie, welcome very much to Science Studio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we get into what does atmospheric chemistry mean, and, you know, is it any different from solution chemistry or any other form of chemistry, let's learn a little bit about Ellie. When you were a little girl, what were your hobbies? What was it that sort of eased you or drove you into a scientific career?
Yeah, so as a child, I was really excited about being outdoors and about playing and exploring. That way we were lucky to live in a community where kind of the homes kind of formed a circle around what was called a common area. So we were really just free to go outside and play with our friends because it was surrounded by homes in a very safe environment, and we were just allowed to explore.
How big was the area? Was it like
it was about 2 acres?
Okay,
that we were just allowed
sufficient.
To run free and explore.
And variations, trees and
there
streams,
was trees or? And kind of an open grassy area, so you could play different games. We would do a lot of make believe and imaginative play. And one summer we were pioneers and we dug a well. Got to a mud pit.
Well, that's interesting.
But
you could have moved into biology. You could have been enamored with all the little creatures that wander around in soil.
I could have, but I ended up as a chemist. And I think part of that was my elementary school education. How science was taught there was a lot of exploration of things. So once a week, parents would donate like old electronics or toaster ovens or things like that. And our science was just take this apart so you start to see how these things work.
And it was part of that game to put it back?
We didn't have to put it back. It was more just kind of
tearing
exploring
it apart.
What the different kind of components were. And that I, as a chemist now, my lab builds new types of instruments. And so it was chemistry was a way of kind of incorporating this exploration in the natural world with also some of this hands-on building things.
And so you're a bit of an engineer.
Yeah, an analytical chemist.
Right, I know, but I mean, the idea of creating instruments, I mean, I've always thought the most difficult thing about that was maintaining the instrument. We might come on to that later.
Well, one of the nice things when you build your own instrument, you also know how to fix it.
Precisely, yes. So anyway, after playing around in mud pits, what was the progression for your education and career?
Yeah, so in high school, I took chemistry as a sophomore and just fell in love with it. I took AP chemistry and then was a TA for chemistry my senior year as a high school student. So I was very fortunate. I've been in public education my entire life, kindergarten through PhD. So it's something I value, and I think good public education. I was lucky to have very good public education.
I think it's key to the success of a state, actually.
I agree.
Another issue. So you went away to university. Where did you study?
Mm-hmm. I was at William & Mary in Virginia, which is
that an old university? I know the name.
It's the second oldest.
Oh, the second.
Harvard is older. William & Mary actually began construction before Harvard. We just didn't open before Harvard.
Oh, interesting. Where is it?
It's in Williamsburg, Virginia. So it was surrounded by Colonial Williamsburg.
Did you do undergraduate research?
I did do undergraduate research. So there's an excellent science at William & Mary, great chemistry department, and a department that really values undergraduate research. And so I started research as a first semester freshman and took a little break in the middle and then finished and continued research in my junior and senior years.
Did you publish anything?
I did not publish anything. I was kind of on projects that were just beginning, and there was a lot of troubleshooting, and I learned a lot about method development.
See, I mean, there's an argument that says that person is equally appropriate for being a co-author, right? Because without your grind, in fact, it's more difficult to do research if it's not going quite the way you want. So you showed a lot of grit in maintaining your interest.
Yeah, and that's a very important part of science that I think we don't realize very much is how much science kind of happens before you get to what's published and how many things you try and don't work out.
Absolutely. So then you went to graduate school straight away, or did you
I went straight away to graduate school.
Where did you go?
I was at University of California, Berkeley, in the chemistry department.
So right across the coast. So in Berkeley, what was your thesis topic?
So there I started atmospheric chemistry research with Ron Cohen in the Department of Chemistry. And I looked at how nitrogen compounds cycle in the atmosphere with a focus on kind of reservoir species. So compounds that move from very reactive species to less reactive species that might later turn into the more reactive species and how those
influence. They recycle.
They recycle.
So it goes from active, non-active, and then chemistry occurs and you're back at square one.
Back to the active, yep. And these particular compounds are really important for understanding ozone production in the troposphere. So the troposphere is the lowest layer of the atmosphere where we live.
The one we can almost touch.
Well, we can touch it. It surrounds us right now. and ozone in the troposphere is a greenhouse gas, and it's also very harmful for human and plant health. It's almost like sandpaper to your lungs.
So what are some of those nitrogen compounds that you initially were introduced to?
Yeah, so the ones that are important for ozone production are nitric oxide and nitrogen dioxide, and those rapidly cycle.
N2O and NO2.
NO and NO2.
Oh, yep. Nitric oxide, sorry.
Nitric oxide, yeah.
Okay.
Nitrous oxide, N2O, is a greenhouse gas and isn't reactive in the troposphere.
It's not?
Nope. It's very long-lived, makes it into the stratosphere.
But so your topic was then to find out how NO, which is reactive, and it's also, for those in the knowledge, it's a free radical. It's got one electron that's sort of hanging around waiting to react, which is the reason it's reactive. And what did you find out that wasn't known before?
So I was particularly interested. So NO and NO2 cycle rapidly, and then they can react with organic compounds in the atmosphere to form what are called organic nitrates. And the organic nitrates are less reactive than NO and NO2. And what my work was focused on was understanding the chemistry of these organic nitrates. And what my research found was that actually organic nitrate formation is starting to become the most significant sink of these, of NO and NO2. Previously, it was thought to be the formation of nitric acid. But because of how primarily the Clean Air Act has been changing our chemistry, we're actually we're changing what the sinks of these compounds are. And then I also found that the lifetime of organic nitrates was much shorter than previously thought.
So they're not quite as inert as you would have implied at the beginning.
So some what my work was looking at was some fraction of the organic nitrates return NO and NO2 to the atmosphere. But then there's also some hydrolysis reactions that turn the organic nitrates into nitric acid. And so my work was looking at understanding kind of the branching between these two pathways, the one that goes on to affect air quality versus the one that kind of removes the nitrogen. And
presumably that's associated with temperature, moisture, irradiation, all the variables that we know about the atmosphere.
Yep, and those are all changing very quickly, and that's what makes studying this chemistry very interesting because it changes on a daily cycle.
And therefore also very difficult to understand in terms of creating, for example, atmospheric policy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if things are changing that rapidly, and because there's sort of these equilibria, you've got the big sink and a little equilibrium on the left, another one on the right. And we all know there's a fellow called Le Chatelier, he's a Frenchman who said any time you try to fiddle with something at equilibrium, it will react in such a way as to negate what you did, all right, and or what you thought you were trying to do. Let me be precise. Well, that's pretty interesting. And so then, you know, the next stage in a career is usually a postdoc somewhere.
Yep.
And quite often, if you're lucky, you go abroad, but I don't think you did.
No, I went to MIT in the Environmental Engineering Department with Jesse Kroll for my postdoc.
That's interesting. So you went from a hard-nosed chemistry department at Berkeley. I know so many people there. These are good, hardworking, you know, people doing really outstanding chemistry. Then you go to an engineering-oriented program. What did you notice?
So I should say the group that I was in was it's still atmospheric chemistry focused. So oftentimes atmospheric chemistry, because it's very interdisciplinary and collaborative, it kind of ends up in different departments. But being in an engineering department was very interesting, especially because environmental engineering encompasses such a wide variety of different disciplines. And so some of the people that sat in the office with me, other postdocs, were looking at like fluid transport and biological systems. And there was people doing water quality in Bangladesh and people looking at how viruses are transported when you sneeze. And so just the variety of research.
Rapidly, I think, is the answer.
Yes. So it was very exciting kind of being around all those different aspects of science.
So what were you doing there?
So there I was still doing atmospheric chemistry, mostly interested in what are called aerosols. So aerosols, it's small suspended solid or liquid particles in the atmosphere. So if you go outside, sometimes you notice that you might not be able to see quite as far. And that's because these aerosols scatter light. The type of aerosols I was interested in are soot and what we call brown carbon. So these are aerosols that, in addition to just scattering light, they absorb solar radiation, which makes them look either black or brown. And rather than scattering radiation and cooling the climate, because they absorb radiation, they act to warm the climate. And so understanding kind of the lifetime and the processing of these is really important for our understanding of climate forcing.
So when you study something like that, it just sounds straightforward. So you can imagine somebody listening to the program would say, oh, I presume she went off to Los Angeles to sample the air, where it was brown in those days, perhaps. Or do you create these atmospheres in the laboratories? Which way would you go?
I actually do both. So by PhD research, I did a lot of field work. We did work in the Sierra Nevadas in California in Bakersfield, and we were on an aircraft that flew all over California as well as the boreal forest and the Arctic looking at air quality. For my postdoc, we predominantly did things in lab, slightly more controlled conditions. But we would also use real-world samples and kind of generating. So we generating some of our samples.
In a nutshell, before we take a break, what did you discover
as a
postdoc?
So a lot of the work was focused on the aging of soot. And I showed that reactions between atmospheric gases, such as the tropospheric ozone that I studied, actually changes the surface of the soot, which is going to change how the soot interacts with water and change how long the soot persists in the atmosphere.
There you are. We're going to take a break there. You're listening to Science Studio. My name's Keith Pannell, and I'm here with Dr. Eleanor Brown, Ellie Brown. She's from the University of Colorado in Boulder, and we'll be back in one brief moment. And we're back with Science Studio, Ellie Brown from the University of Colorado in Boulder, and my name, Keith Pannell. So now we've got your career development and the interesting things you've been doing. All of a sudden, you get a faculty position. You're on your own. You have to sort of put up or shut up, I think. You have 6 years in which to prove that you are really worthy of a tenured position in a major university. What did you decide to investigate? That's the first key question.
So I combined my research interests from my graduate work with my postdoctoral work, and I'm really looking at how nitrogen compounds act to form aerosols in the atmosphere. So how we go from gas phase particles to particles that kind of nucleate and then grow and form these aerosols in the atmosphere. And nitrogen compounds end up being very important in this, specifically compounds like ammonia and different amines because they're bases.
You mean these are the crude materials that go into the atmosphere and you're looking at how they transform from whatever they are, gases, into the aerosol.
Into particles, yes.
So does that need some nucleation site?
Yes, so kind
dust,
of
the,
for example. So I'm looking at how gases start forming clusters. So we actually start with one molecule, it clusters with a second one, and then keeps growing, rather than kind of pre-existing surfaces like dust or aerosols emitted from cars or industry or something like that. And the reason that we're concerned with kind of this nucleation and growth process is because these are the what are called ultrafine aerosols. So the aerosols less than 100 nanometers in diameter. And these small aerosols are very important for forming clouds. And thus, they're very important for our understanding climate. And they're also a huge human health concern because most things like dust, our nasal passages will filter them out. These ultrafine aerosols will go deep into your lungs, and there they cause substantial health outcomes. And there's been some studies in the news recently showing things like some of these particles get into your lungs and they can move throughout your body. And people have found some of these soot aerosols actually cross the placenta of pregnant women.
Okay, but I mean, that's the carbon, the soot. But I'm intrigued. You said that how to, for example, we'll take ammonia, how it clusters.
Yes.
Well, I think we can briefly say that water is a very polar molecule, and waters interact with one another via a weak electrostatic force called a hydrogen bond. Ammonia does the same. Is that the beginning of the process?
So it's one of the important steps at the beginning. How most nucleation starts is with sulfuric acid. So sulfuric acid is formed in the atmosphere.
I mean, the listeners saying, oh, there's stuff out in my atmosphere. So it's not just the nitrogen. We'll stick with ammonia. You need other ingredients in the atmosphere, too.
Yes.
And sulfuric acid comes from incomplete combustion of, well, sulfur to sulfur dioxide. That reacts with water. So you need a whole range of
you
materials.
Need a whole range of things.
If we were clever, we didn't have any sulfuric acid because we didn't have sulfur dioxide.
Well, there's
we'd
always
be healthier.
There's always some sulfur in the atmosphere from natural emissions of things. So, like the ocean gives off a lot of a compound called dimethyl sulfide, and once that's in the atmosphere, that's actually chemically transformed, and it ends up forming sulfuric acid.
Dimethyl sulfide comes from bacterial or
various sources
animal
in the
decomposition.
Ocean. Yes.
Right.
Yeah, there's also sources from agriculture and things like that over the continents.
So what are you discovering at the moment in this field?
Yeah, so as an atmospheric chemist, one of the things we do is we take our instruments out into the field and we try to measure some of these events. And so far, we took our instruments to this Department of Energy field site in Oklahoma to measure some of these new particle formation events. And we were there for 5 weeks, and unfortunately, the atmosphere didn't cooperate, as might be expected when you're studying a natural system. So we weren't able to investigate kind of this new particle formation, but we have been finding a lot of interesting kind of nitrogen chemistry in general. And one of the things that we have found is actually the presence of gas phase urea, which urea is a nitrogen compound that people might know from the smell. It's a very potent smelling compound. It comes from animals. It's a fertilizer. And then it's also being used in trucks right now for selective catalytic reduction.
It is?
Mm-hmm. So
the urea is a catalyst?
So the urea is used as part of the catalytic system to convert these, the NO and the NO2 into N2. So people have measured urea in aerosols before, but it had never been measured in the gas phase. And
so this means you have very sophisticated instrumentation.
Yes.
You just don't go out and sit in a field in Oklahoma or any other state for that matter and just gaze around like we non-atmospheric scientists do because we just like what we see. You have very sophisticated, are these infrared or UV, or what are you looking for?
the tools that my group predominantly uses are different varieties of mass spectrometry. So mass spectrometry, you can measure the molecular composition by you charge the molecules and then kind of separate them somehow by their mass to charge ratio.
So how do you sample? Do you just have pumps that are concentrating somehow the sample into a smaller volume that you then investigate with this mass spectrometry, or how does it work?
So we do what's called online mass spectrometry. So we have our mass spectrometer that just samples air continuously, and we're just measuring these compounds in real time with 1 second or better time resolution. So it's there's been a lot of work done on this instrumentation to make sure that we can really measure these compounds because they're present in incredibly low mixing ratios. So
that's the whole problem, I suppose. Presumably, instrumentation is now so much superior that you can, in fact, take into account all these very other materials that are background, which has got nothing to do with your project.
Yes. So the type of mass spectrometry we do is, we first put a very high resolving power mass spectrometer on our instrument so that we could actually see kind of the different ions at, for instance, M to Z 28. So we can see N2, we can separate out N2 from CO from some of the other compounds there. The other thing that we do is, in order to do mass spectrometry, you first have to put a charge on the molecules. And what we do, it's called chemical ionization. And so it's more selective for certain types of compounds. So we kind of reduce the complexity by only ionizing certain things.
So you can say, this is my target molecule, let's say it's urea. And therefore, we will do a different type of excitation or ionization in this case. Interesting. Well, I mean, I use mass spectrometry. My students use mass spectrometry. And the sophistication of that technique over the last decades or so is phenomenal. Mass spec of mass spec and all the rest of it, it goes on and on. But these are big machines, instruments. I mean, how do you grab one of those things and take it out to Oklahoma in a field?
So the one that we use, it's about 5 feet by 2 feet by 1 foot or so. And it only weighs around 130 pounds.
It's full of vacuum.
There's a lot of empty space. So we have a crate. We put it in the crate. We get a few people. We load it into the back of a rental truck and we drive it. Some of my colleagues actually install the same sorts of mass spectrometers on research aircraft, and they fly these research aircraft all over. There is a big kind of campaign that just concluded that took place in the western United States measuring emissions from wildfires. And there were many mass spectrometers on this NASA and NOAA aircraft to look at these.
Well, the little instrument that 35 years ago I had on a helicopter, I mean, it was sweet. It was naive. I mean, helicopters are noisy. They vibrate like the devil. And so,
that's a challenging measurement platform.
Right, this was before all of the computerized storage of digital data. And it was a bit hopeless. But it was enjoyable, I must say. Well, what have you learned? Do you have preliminary results that you care to share about what you're seeing in your study?
With regard to the new particle formation?
Well, let's stick with urea.
The urea. I mean. Yeah. We're the first people to actually measure its presence as a gas in the atmosphere.
Oh, really?
So some people have kind of hypothesized that it will probably be there, but there just haven't really been the measurement techniques to look for it before. And so what my group did was we developed some of these measurement techniques, and we found this molecule in the atmosphere. And what we're now working on doing is understanding kind of what's controlling its concentration, because we see that the concentration kind of varies throughout the day, and then it also varies day to day.
Let's go to that one then. Is there a photochemical process here? So, I mean, do you see in large amounts at nighttime, or what are these variations due to?
Mm-hmm. So typically the sort of profile we see is that it's higher at night, kind of decreases early in the morning, and then kind of late afternoon starts increasing a little bit. One of the challenging things about interpreting atmospheric measurements is that we actually, the atmosphere is continuously changing. And one of the things that's happening is kind of The layer of the atmosphere closest to the Earth we call the boundary layer. And the size of the boundary layer changes throughout the day because of heating of the surface that kind of heats the air and the box expands, and then at night it cools. So some of this change in concentration is just due to changing the box size that you're looking at. And so what we've been doing is looking at how that influences it. And we find that that explains some of the change in concentration, but not all of it. And so what we think, some of the kind of emissions that we're seeing are actually, Oklahoma, there's a huge agricultural industry and the site's influenced in that. And urea is used as a fertilizer. And we think we're seeing some emissions of urea either from fertilizer application or from microbial activity that's changing some of the nitrogen into urea because it's a byproduct of kind of metabolism.
Right. So, I mean, basically you've made a discovery that no one knew before. And that's always good for a scientist.
Right? It's exciting. It's why we do science.
As long as it's a field that has some prior history of being significant, if you like. I mean, there's not one of us that couldn't look at the periodic table and say, well, let's make a molecule over here, and you'll find that there's been a 30,000 of these molecules before, but you can tweak. It's the, what would he call it, methyl, ethyl, propyl, butyl, futyl, you know, sort of work. In your case, you've looked for a specific material that had been hypothesized. Why had they hypothesized its presence?
So it's been observed before in aerosols and in rain,
but just
not in the gas phase.
Got you.
And it's been thought to be important in the gas phase because it can be important in this new particle formation process.
So when you're doing your mass spectrometry, how do you make sure you don't include any aerosols?
So the aerosols are typically much larger, and so they don't show up. They don't have the same mass. They have a mass outside the range that our mass spectrometer can detect.
Hang on a minute. I mean, if I think about what little mass spectrometry I know, you can take solutions that have all sorts of components, and by the time you vaporize them and ionize them, you can remove the solvent or agglomeration, and you see the individual molecule.
Yep.
That can't happen with an aerosol containing urea, rather?
So that depends kind of on the interface between the atmosphere and the mass spectrometer that you use. The interface that we use is just a tube kind of sticking out the wall of the building that we're taking measurements in. So we're not heating the air at all, so it's not actually making any of these particles evaporate.
Well done. Ellie Brown from the University of Colorado.
Thank you. It's been fun chatting about this.
Right, it certainly has, and we've learned a lot. And we'll see you everybody the same time next week. Bye-bye.